Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you this morning?
I'm wonderful. So, how are yourself?
I'm doing a lot better, and that we got our favorite guest in the podcast room.
Who do you got for us?
Mr. Glenn Longaball, our technical agronomist at Premier Ag.
The man, the myth, the legend.
Good morning, all.
And to start the question of the day off, this is one he ought to have a whole list, because he's always outstanding in his field, is what is the strangest thing you've ever found in the fields, walking the fields?
Yeah, well, so the strangest thing I've ever found, I've never run into any dead bodies, no black bears, nothing like that, like the fellows in the Southeast. But a few years ago, I started into a tile project up the side of a hill, and this is before I'd had a lot of experience with voles. And I had a series of what looked like suck holes. You know, if you've ever seen where a tile breaks and starts sucking the soil in, that's what this looked like.
I've never heard it called that before.
Yeah. Well, there's blow holes. Those are the ones where it blows out. And then there's suck holes where typically it has a void below it and just had a hole. If you just have a hole in a tile, it'll start sucking soil through that
hole.
We
know that, but I've never heard sinkholes.
Yeah.
Anyway,
and those holes are always in the same track as where your ammonia wagon goes, and then the ammonia wagon rolls over.
I haven't had that experience, but you obviously have. So we call this the Lilland Farm. And a few years ago, I was at the Lilland Farm, and begrudgingly, I went up the side of this hill because there was a series of holes, you know, in this hill, and I just knew that it had to either be a clay tile, because this farm does have a clay tile, right? It sat idle for 50 years. And since then, you know, we took it out of CRP and it's had, after we bought it, and it's had, you know, two or three 200 plus bushel corn crops on it and really good soybeans. But there's a series of holes up the side of the hill. And I'm just sure that it's clay tile. Well, I get up there and start digging around. There's no clay tile. Well, it also has oil field stuff on it, right? It's got injection lines across this farm. It's got flow lines, and it's like, son of a gun. You know, I'm just sure that it's some artifact from the oil field folks that I wrestle with, you know, with some regularity. And I excavated the whole side of this hill off and couldn't find any clay tile, couldn't find any oil field artifacts. It was like, what in the heck is going on? And I noticed a few critters, you know, whenever I was dipping soil out. Finally, I get down in the hole and get feeling around, and it's not a tile hole at all. It's actually, there was a hole, probably, it was oval in shape, but probably 10, 12 inches across and probably 8 inches tall. And what it was is the water had gone in to a vole colony at the top of the slope. And the water then underground had moved from vole colony to vole colony and created erosion underground, which then collapsed and created this series of suck holes down the slope. But I'm telling you, in my mind, I had cursed those oil field guys up and down, because I was just sure that it was, you know, that it was some mess that they had left me behind, and turns out it was just voles. And now, you know, that I'm kind of in tune to it, you know, we've recognized them in lots of places, you know, especially in our fields that have been no-tilled for some period of time. They are a real problem, and to the point where even though I've never really had any love lost for coyotes, I now appreciate the coyotes, and we're probably gonna you know, in the past, if you called Jeff, we'd probably still give you permission. But in the past, we've never really turned people down for permission to coyote hunt. But we may do that in the future, right?
A guy comes up from Missouri and traps back there on me. But yeah, you're right. Those voles, and there's not a really good control method, is there?
Well, there's some. I mean, you can still get zinc phosphite. Personally, I don't really like spreading it around, because I'm always concerned that I'm going to hurt wildlife or this, that, and the other. But if a guy uses bait, what we did this year was we went and actually just treated the colonies themselves instead of broadcasting the whole field, right? Because I really don't want to poison any turkeys. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hurt any other critters. But yeah, tillage or bait is about the only way to really control them. And it's not just the voles, right? Since we started, I think what's changed is the kids are using thermal now, right? They've got you know, thermal scopes on these rifles, allows them to go out after dark, do coyote calls, and you know, do coyote sets, and really effectively put a dent in them. I've actually got groundhogs again, right? We went years and years. You know, when I was a kid, that was the major summertime.
Loved hunting groundhogs.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, just go out there and sit and
pasture pigs.
Absolutely, it was kind of one of our primary means of entertainment through the summer. Right, was sitting and waiting on a coyote to come up out of a hole, not a coyote, but a groundhog
with a .22 Magnum.
And you know, we went 30 years, you didn't hardly see any groundhogs, and now suddenly we have groundhogs back again. So I think as long as they're western coyotes, they're not big coy dogs, I think we probably need to leave some for seed, just because they're you know, a coyote can dig, you know, until the ground gets frozen, a coyote can dig his entire day's groceries in just a you know, fraction of an hour.
Yep.
And so they do us a lot of good, them and the birds of prey. You know, we don't always appreciate them because we think they're getting the bunny rabbits and the quail, but they probably do us more harm or more good than harm.
People are putting those poles out in the fields now in the high spots for the hawks to roost on.
Yep, to try to get the voles.
Well, Jeff, do you have a better strange,
you know,
story than that?
When I was in high school, we were farming a bunch of ground around Fishers, and that's back before Fishers exploded up on the north side of Indy. And it was just a little one-horse town back then, but it was kind of just outside of the Indy area. And we used to find, you know, stolen stuff dumped in fields, and we found a motorcycle. That was, you know, there.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind of strange. Just you coming up, and you know, there's a bean field. All of a sudden, it's like, what is that? And there's a motorcycle laying on its side. It was... I think it was like a Honda 450 or something.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was actually a road bike, and you know, smaller one, but yeah, that was kind of odd.
I found this was weird. It was insulation, like house insulation out in the field, and we turned out it was from the tornado and thunderstorms in Evansville. That far away, it got up in the atmosphere, I guess, and carried it that far.
We used to find we'd find a balloon every once in a while, and somebody'd write, you know, if you find this balloon, and I remember as a kid, we found one, and I cannot remember where it came from, but I remember it was a couple states away.
Oh, wow.
And that was kind of cool.
Yeah. It got up that high and just kept going, I guess.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Well, what's the state of the union?
Yeah.
As far as our 25-30 county radius right here.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. It's all over the board, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's never consistent across all of southern Indiana, but it's there are truly haves and have-nots this year. And some of the areas that we think of as being normally really progressive and they have a good soil resource, and it's oftentimes well drained, like up at Greensburg. You know, they've got some folks up there that have really, really struggled to get in a crop. But you know, east to west, the tale is the same. We've had a less than optimal conditions to put in a crop. If you really waited for the ground to get right this year, you probably didn't get anything planted.
You might still be waiting.
Absolutely. So
It seems like in years past, we'd have areas, okay, this southwest part of the state was good and southeast was struggled, or vice versa. But this year, it's like every individual farm has, well, this field really looks good, and everything else I put in after this date is struggling.
Yes. And so to me, it harkens back to 2019. And 2019 was a really wet spring. The difference was in 2019, we got these 5-6 inch, followed by a 4 inch, followed by a 3 inch, right? It was these huge rain events that caused, you know, a lot of flooding, if not from backwater, at least from headwater, right? And, you know, headwater would be the clear rain runoff, mm-hmm. where backwater is where in southern Indiana, right? We've got, you know, we've got the Muscatatuck, we've got the White, we've got the Patoka, we've got the Wabash, we've got the Ohio,
the White River.
You know, we've got all these rivers. And when they back up, the water that comes into these, you know, these lacustrine soils or alluvium soils.
You're reverse flooding.
It goes up all the tributaries, and you end up with like really dark, you know, it's typically really muddy water, right? We think of that as backwater as opposed to the rainwater that just can't get away fast enough is headwater, right? For those listeners that are not familiar. But this year, what was different is it wasn't the amplitude of the events. It was the frequency, right? It seemed like every other day you got a trace to 3/10 to an inch, right? Typically you had to have an inch or an inch and a half event to get the ground kind of saturated, get you past field capacity. And then as opposed to, well, 2 days later, it's starting to gray off, you'd get a trace or you'd get, 3/10 or something that was just enough to get it back to where it's sloppy mess, right? And
I know we had I talked to a grower in the same thing. It's just been a struggle. Planting been a struggle for us to get fertilizer and chemicals on the field. And at the time I talked to him, I had looked backwards through the rain events. And out of 56 days that I had gone back, the previous 56 days from that date that we met, 27 of those 56 days we had measurable rainfall in Greensburg.
Yeah. Donna, of all people, right? My wife, I oftentimes think is unconscious to this, but she's the one that keeps track of, you know, where we were at, what we did, and she records it totally independently of what I tell her, and which is actually good, right? Because I'm often too close to my work. She did the math the other day and said, we've planted for 3 months and it's actually only been 9 days. And some of those might have just been a 15 or a 20 acre or some kind of a patch, right? But we literally only planted for 9 days in 3 months.
Oh my
God. And I can tell you.
You need to start working a little harder, Glenn.
Yeah.
Well, you've been taking too many days off.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly what I needed to hear. Thanks, Jeff. So, just like last night.
That's what Donna's trying to tell you, that you need to work harder.
That's right. That's exactly what she's trying to tell me. No, she recognizes that it's been a challenge to get stuff in. And you know what? I may not be done planting yet. I've got, later today, I'm going to go try to evaluate some stuff. And, it's stuff that's burnt down in April, got planted that first week of June. And every spring, there are some voodoo dates, right? There's some dates that, everybody goes out and plants. They probably push it. Rain's forecasted again. At the time, it started raining right after it got done. It's like, I think it was the 4th or 5th of June, and it started raining right after it got done. And even though I was in, way too wet of conditions, it's like, well, at least it's behind me, right? Hopefully I'll get a stand because I upplanted it. You know what? If you're not going to get a stand with 140,000, you're probably not going to get a stand with 160,000, right? It's just, that's the way it works. And so, it may be a deal where I'm, we've got a 5 day, 6 day window of above normal temperatures and they're forecasting wind and high pressure and we should dry up. So yeah, if there's anything that you wanted to do a do over on, this might be the week to get it done. But we're actually still too wet, right? I mean, it's wet enough that I probably still won't spray it till Saturday or Sunday because I don't want to track it all up. If we are going to leave it, I don't want to track it up.
Well, the forecast this year seemed to have burned us because obviously. You don't want to go plant right in front of a big rain. But I remember it was a Wednesday. There was rain forecast on Thursday, but it was only like 2 to 4 tenths. We got an inch and a half. So everybody that planted on that Wednesday, I'm pretty sure they got to do a lot of that over.
Oh, yeah. 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 The answer plot at Lagodi has got some pretty big holes in the front range just because of that very thing. Yeah. So
you're right, though, Jeff. It seems like what you call the amplitude, but the quantity of rain has been totally missed.
Yeah, they forecast an inch and a half, and so everybody hold off, then we'd get 2 tenths.
Yeah.
So, well, I should have gone then. So,
yeah, well,
good win for losing this year.
Yeah, but when you watch the radar, it's little cells, there's light rain over the entire area, right? And then there's these little cells, and what we're asking them to do is predict. Give us the amplitude for this spot, and that's almost impossible to do. Compared to the forecast of 20 years ago, it's spectacular, right? How close they come, right? Wind direction, wind speed, temperature, man, those things are pretty.
A lot of info.
Yeah, they're pretty close, right? That precipitation is so incredibly hard to predict, right? Because you don't you don't know where the individual cells are going to pop up.
Well, we're talking about weather, and I went back and tried to find this email. I saw an article just a couple days ago, and it said they've already seen tar spot.
Yep.
Is that just a little bit early?
Not really. So you think about it, last year, tar spot was found in June in northern Indiana and never materialized. The year before, it was found actually at the end of April in Gibson County, never really materialized. So just know that finding a lesion, finding where tar spot has made an infection, and having an epidemic are two totally different things.
Okay.
And typically when you have early infections, right, this is something that I get kind of frustrated with even pathologists, right, that are trained in just pathology, is oftentimes they, you know, those folks don't really get a lot of glamour, right? They don't get a lot of attention. And yet once they find, once they can start to predict an epidemic, right, they oftentimes exaggerate, right? And so that's where we're at. Think about this, right? Plants don't make very good hosts when they're small, because when they're in grand growth, all the resources that they produce, right, all the photosynthate, the glucose they're producing, already has a destination, right? It's being used to build new tissue. And that tissue is not rich in photosynthate, right? It's rich in cellulosic material and moisture and maybe nutrition, but the sugar is being used for cell growth, cell elongation, and so photosynthate levels, sugar levels in the plant are typically always low when it's in the vegetative stage, because you're using it up, right? You're making new roots down below ground. You're making new leaf tissue above ground. The reason why diseases become epidemic in reproductive stage is because once you get into reproduction, typically vegetative growth halts or at least slows, and the plant becomes much richer in photosynthate. That's what those diseases are there for, wow. Right? Those diseases are there to actually not predispose the plant. That wouldn't serve their interest. They're there to capture, to collect photosynthate from the plant, go through their life cycle, produce more young. I mean, produce spores and propagate themselves, right? That's what they're there for. But that's why plants typically, if you ever have an epidemic, it doesn't happen typically during vegetative stage. It happens during reproduction, because the plant is a much better host, right? I often, I think about the disease triangle occasionally and every pathologist, every armchair pathologist that's ever talked about disease has talked about the disease triangle and what it takes to have an epidemic. And of course, oftentimes they make like, well, you have to have a susceptible host, right? And by the way, disease triangle is made up of three things, really should be four, right? One is you have to have disease present. You have to have the inoculum present. You have to have favorable environmental conditions, right? The third thing is you have to have a susceptible host. But there's really a fourth component, right? And George Waters is the one that made me aware of this, right? It takes time, right? You can have those first three, but if it's drying out real quickly in the day, right, and you say, well, it's part of favorable environmental conditions. Could be. But whether we're talking about how much free moisture and how long does it have to stay wet for the disease to set up housekeeping, or how long does it take for the disease to go from infection to sporulation, right, which would be like the latent period. There's always a time, there's a temporal component. But every one of those variables, right, when you think about susceptible host, right? We make oftentimes like, well, it's this variety is susceptible, this variety is not, right? This crop is susceptible, this crop is not. In the case of an individual crop, right, there is, corn might be very susceptible during R3, R4, and yet not very susceptible at all at V6, right? Why? Because at V6, again, the plant itself is not a very good target. It's not a very good host for disease. At R3, R4, where that plant is, because it doesn't have a circulatory system like we do, it does have a vascular system, but it's not, it doesn't physically, well, it does physically, it's just different, right? The plant has to move photosynthate from the tissue to the seed, right, or to the grain, the part that we're interested in recovering, right? It has to move that via a vascular system. That vascular system is the transport, right? That's the highway, if you will, for glucose, and that's certainly what those diseases are there for, right?
Wow.
They're trying to make a living. So a host is not a host is not a host. Even within a particular host, again, there's a temporal component, right? If it's early, vegetative, it's probably not a very good host at all.
All right. Well, I saw that and I'm like, great. This just adds insult to injury.
Yeah. So we've had pathologists find tar spot the last several years, way early in the season. That does not necessarily equate, just like anthracnose, right?
We'll take that as good news. Then.
Yeah, it's good news. As long as we manage a crop for tar spot, for southern rust, for there are other diseases besides tar spot and southern rust, right? Right now, you'd think the entire world revolves around tar spot. Well, guess what? We still get physoderma. We still get southern corn leaf blight. We still get gray leaf spot, right? And gray leaf spot still probably takes as many bushels from the entire corn belt as these other diseases do. Wow. Individually. So, so when we talk about managing, yes, we could change our management to just affect tar spot, but what happens to the gray leaf spot and the physoderma that's set up kind of late vegetative?
You win the battle, lose the war.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a great analogy, Jeff.
So based on the conditions we've had this spring, and they've been all over the board, what's a couple, two or three of the main watchouts that you're...
So I have seen some anthracnose, and once it dries up, that'll probably go away. With this kind of rainfall event and the way it's set up, you'll probably see some bacterial leaf spot. That's nothing to be concerned about. But I would fully expect to see some gray. I would fully expect to see some northern, right, because it's been cool. I would fully expect to see physoderma again this year because of the moisture. So, but we'll see. I mean, you think about it, we've had a fair amount of foliar disease, but we've gone through five consecutive dry Junes, right? And basically the weather in June, late vegetative, right? That grand growth stage being dry has really influenced us having fairly healthy crops when we get to the R stages, right?
Yeah.
This time we've got a lot of moisture. And oh, by the way, you know, the entire Premier Service Area is not a disaster, right? I mean, you can find pockets of unbelievably good crops in our service area. And those early planted crops, which maybe started out gourd yellow and red down at the bottom because it was, short on oxygen, right? By the way, that's what was going on, right? When you saw these yellow crops, I get call after call, hey, can we go, is there something we can do to prop it up, make it look better? And it's like, well, when it starts to recover, because it becomes aerobic, it'll make it look better, but it's not going to fix it on its own, right?
Hmm.
It's a function of below ground, that plant is only respiring. And when you have saturated conditions, the reason why these springs on the sides of hills have stayed yellow, the rest of the field greens up, goes into grand growth, and then you still have this stunted yellow, almost like red at the bottom corn on these hillsides where the springs come out. That's because it's anaerobic. And those plants are having a hard time sequestering what they need.
They need some dry feet.
because basically the roots are smothering, right? Because they only respire. They don't photosynthesize.
So one of the other things I've heard so far this spring, we've had some wind events, and I heard of some green snap. Have you seen, is that widespread?
That's been really recent, right? So yeah. Day before yesterday, we had a wind event, depending on where you were at, what time of the day it was, but it's kind of late evening. And yeah, we've got small corn laid over almost all the way across the trade territory, across Premier's territory, with some of the worst spots being right here, like at Cortland at the answer plot. That was planted real early, was pretty vulnerable, and depending on the variety, the population, the stage, some of it green snapped pretty bad. I haven't seen whole fields. I was really interested yesterday when I went back through Davis County. I was looking because there's some really early planted, really good-looking corn over there, and I was scared to death it was going to be snapped. And there is some green snap, but it's mostly around the perimeter. It's in... Have you ever noticed how the the architecture of a plant, corn, will change when you get close to a yard or a trees, right? You would expect the wind to be lower when you get close to those trees. But because the corn is taller, right, has, you know, because it was shaded, it produced more gibberellic acid. Gibberellic acid made the internodes elongate. Those elongated, internodes then are more brittle when you have good moisture, right? That's one of the reasons why we had green snap, is because we had all this moisture and then had a rain event. When there's lots of moisture, the cells are really turgid, right? They're nice and plump and full. And when they're in grand growth, in other words, we're like at V12, and you're putting on new leaf every 2.5-3 days, right? So the cells are rapidly replicating themselves through mitosis, right? It's asexual reproduction, right? Those cells are thin-walled and really plump, full of moisture, what we call turgid, and they are susceptible. Wow. Once that corn would flower and vegetative growth stops, you don't have mitosis. You don't have thin cell walls. The plants are almost completely resistant to green snap once they flower.
Just but, bad timing.
Yeah, it's just bad timing. And we get this almost every year somewhere. Hmm. But I don't want to condemn this crop, because I'm telling you, yeah, there's a lot of potential out there. I came over, I wasn't quite to your neighborhood, Sal, but just west of you.
Yeah.
I came out of Paoli and went over a hill and looked across the countryside, and it was absolutely breathtaking. All the hills are covered with corn. Corn was all in grand growth, all had good color, very uniform. I was just like, wow, this is the way corn's supposed to look. And I would hope those guys are going to, you know, appreciate that and really treat that corn special. But, you know, even some of this corn that started out really pale and uneven and stunted because of anaerobic conditions, it's starting to come out of it now, and there's still lots of potential there. So we still need to manage going forward, like, and we're going to have a crop.
And like you said, I mean, we're doing a lot of fungicide applications. I mean, that's pretty common now, sure, common practice. And even in that vegetative stage, making another fungicide application.
Absolutely.
With a mid-tier.
Yeah, this is a great time to not only to get your first pass fungicides on, it's a great time to think about propping up your nutrition, right? So, you know, at Premier, we like to try to consult to a little higher level, maybe, than some of the competitors. You use tissue sampling, to give us some insights into what is the best use of our resources, right? So I think oftentimes tissue sampling is so misunderstood, because, you know, growers have a tissue sample taken, they get the results back, on their best looking field of corn, and half the things come back deficient, and they're like, oh my gosh, this thing says I'm a bad farmer. Well, that's not what the tissue says at all, right? The tissue sampling, the tissue sample itself, if it comes back with several things deficient, it's basically telling you that that plant is probably growing really rapidly, right? And what the condition is called dilution effect, right? The more rapidly the plant is growing, typically the more dilute those nutritional values will be, right? In fact, it's not uncommon at all for the best looking corn to have some of the poorest tissue samples, and the poorest looking corn to have some of the best tissue samples. Because you take a plant, for example, that's been waterlogged and not growing actively, it's got all that nutrition there and is not being disseminated into new cells, right? Because as a plant puts on new leaves, and the cells are going through mitosis, and they're dividing from one cell, one diploid cell, into two diploid cells. Guess what? You know, you're now dividing, as you put on biomass, you're dividing that load of nutrition, across more cells. And by the way, during grain growth, the uptake doesn't stop either, right? In 300 bushel corn, you're taking up in excess of 15 pounds of K2O per day. And jeez, so these are sometimes the insights that we gain that are most useful, right? First of all, if a grower hasn't done tissue sampling, just know that a tissue sample is not a report card on how good a farmer you are or how poor a farmer you are, right? What a tissue sample really is, and this is hard for us to get across to growers and sometimes even consultants, a tissue sample is a great way to appreciate where your opportunity is, right? If you're short on N, you know, nitrogen, and you're short on sulfur, and you're short on boron, those are things that are fairly easy to fix, right? We're spinning on, you know, we've got, there's a machine just west of us right now that's spraying urea and ammonium sulfate, and it's possible they've got some boron in there, maybe not, but those are anions. Those are almost always short when we get in grand growth or when we had excess moisture. And, you know, that's a great way.
I passed through those machines on the way in.
Sure.
So, yeah. We got Campbellsburg and Cortland running out west of town. So
we do. Yeah. Absolutely.
That's so pretty neat when they kind of concentrate in one area and it looks like.
They obviously had a, you know, some dry ground to go.
Yeah, they found it.
Yeah. What is it that guy says over at Premier? He says, oh, we're Premier. We can do anything.
Yeah, we got this. Yeah. We're built for this.
Yeah.
Well, Glenn, thanks for being. We're going to have some grower meetings throughout the summer. Of course, sure. We've got the answer plots coming up here at the, in August. And as always, if you've not had a chance to come and hear Glenn talk, you can hear him in person by coming to the answer plots. And he's always in the territory. Well, Jeff, you got anything else?
No, I think Glenn's refreshed. He's only worked 9 days this spring.
Oh, my so gosh.
That's still our take home.
<That's>
thank you, Donna.
Yeah. I was going to say it was my pleasure, but I'm not sure.
All right. Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.